As you take your Bibles and turn with me to Ephesians chapter 3, verses 8 to 10, just a reminder that there is Capstone this week. So Capstone is just an opportunity that we have twice a month to come together Thursday mornings at the Granville Island Hub, which is just above the restaurant Wet when you come into the Granville Island area. We meet there 7 o'clock in the morning. And so if you're a regular part of that, and we got about 45, almost 50 people now that make that a regular part of their kind of their monthly calendar. Just a reminder, we're going through the topic, what is death? Of all topics, we're going through that one this week. So it should be good. It's sort of a communal approach, conversational approach, walking through some of the key tenets of our faith. And so a reminder for some of you and an invite for others. If you want to join us on Thursday, you are always invited, even if you can't make it every time. Certainly make this Thursday work if you want to. We'd love to have you. All right, let me pray. Good to see you. Father, thank you for today. I pray that you guide us today. Discussion, the stuff that we're working through, for some, I know there's going to be resistance to it, sort of maybe indifference. So I pray that you maybe break into that. For others, that they just fired up about this whole topic. I pray that their enthusiasm would be used maybe to encourage others. I pray that nothing that I say would be against or in opposition to what you have for this ministry, that my enthusiasm for this would not be in some way a replacement for something that you're not up to. So I pray for that. I pray that you would open and close doors and help us to break through doors that you've put in the way to be broken down to demonstrate your work through us as well. So I pray for all of that in Jesus' great name. Amen. Super Bowl Sunday. Yeah, I've got a big thing of chili at home, just simmering. It's going to be great. Chili Sunday. Where am I? Oh, yeah, we're planting hopefully you know this. We're planting a campus on the North Shore of Vancouver. We've talked about that much, lots of information about that. A launch team is currently in training and preparation mode right now for the launch of that North Shore campus. A contract with the Park and Tilford Cinemas has been signed. And so Park and Tilford Cinemas it's close to Second Narrows. So if you go across the Second Narrows heading into the North Shore and you take the Main Street exit and you sort of double toward, like, you're heading into the North Shore, North Van area. It's only a couple minutes from there. We are purchasing the initial startup necessities already. James, Bonnie's wife, Nikki, their two kids, they've moved to the North Shore, been there now for several months. Matt, his wife, Dawn, their four kids, searching out places to live on the North Shore as well. And our prayerful commitment is that we would launch this new campus of Westside on April 1st, 2012. So a couple of months from now, which I know is April Fool's Day. All right, I understand that. But more significantly, it's Palm Sunday as well, the next week being Easter. So we're going with that and not the April Fool's thing. In connection with this, beginning next Sunday, we are beginning a four-week fundraising campaign that we've entitled Sent and Sending. With our hope for this campaign, which will end with a party at the Roundhouse Community Center on March 14th, with the goal being to raise $75,000 for the initial startup costs of this new campus. Now, what are startup costs? Well, they have to do with things like lighting and sound and portable storage needs, because we can't store there, signage, lobby needs, kids ministry needs, PR work, all of that kind of stuff. So we are launching that next week, Sent and Sending, a four-week campaign. It doesn't mean that after 4 weeks that it's going to be done necessarily. It just means that over the next 4 weeks, again, beginning next week, we'll be highlighting different aspects of church planting here, church planting in the city, church planting across the nation. Now, why are we calling the campaign Sent and Sending? Well, quite simply, because we worship and follow a God who is both sent and sending. The Father sent the Son, perhaps the most well-known verse in all of the Bible, for God so loved the world that he sent his only begotten Son. But Jesus sent the Spirit. He states in the Upper Room Discourse to his disciples, "It's to your advantage that I go away, For if I do not go away, the Helper will not come to you, speaking of the Holy Spirit, but if I go, I will send him to you. So God the Father sends God the Son sends the Spirit. Jesus as well sends us. In John chapter 17, that high priestly prayer, Jesus prays to his Father, as you have sent me into the world, so I have sent them into the world. And lastly, but I wouldn't say leastly, because I don't think it's a sort of a one-up type of activity. I just think it's a modeling activity. The church sends people out. After fasting and praying, we read in Acts 13:3, for example, they laid hands on Paul and Barnabas, the Antioch, church at Antioch did, and sent them off. And I think if you were to pick one word sort of resounding in our ears before Jesus ascended to the right hand of the Father, it's the word go. Go, right? My work's done with you here, physically speaking. I'm leaving. I'm going. I'm sending the Spirit. When the Spirit comes, he empowers, he emboldens. Now you go. When we first started discussing the campaign, my initial reaction was, we've never done one before. Other than the initial startup at Westside, that's all I did was ask people for money. But, you know, because we had none. And so you don't have a body, you don't have anything. You just go into people and go, I'll speak for you if you give us some money. To which they said, not worth it. We just kept on asking for money and raising money and all of that. And so we did an initial campaign. But as I got to think about it, I thought, you know, that's not true. We do campaigns every year. We do campaigns in connection with overseas missions every year. We send people on missions to other parts of the world every year that have costs connected to them that are actually larger than what we're trying to raise in this campaign. For example, for us to send 20, 21, 22 people to India costs about $75,000. Meaning that people have to raise, in the conjunction of that group, and we usually send far more, $75,000, which again is the amount of money that we want to raise in this campaign. But I know we are challenged on this side of the planet. Because on this side of the planet, there is this idea that missions is over there, not here. Here we do church, right? We do church. There we do missions. Here, we don't need very much, we need very little. There, they need much. Here, we need little, there, they need much. Now, on the one hand, I do agree. On the one hand, I agree that the physical plight, and in some parts of the world, the spiritual plight of those in those parts of the world is far greater than ours. I get that. I've read the books. I've seen the web pages. I'm with you. I totally agree with you. I've been to India myself for three times. I've seen it firsthand. And I know, in fact, that there's other parts of the world that are like it. So I understand why people rally more easily to a campaign that sends people to parts of the world that are so desperate. However, and it's a big however, the idea that the needs are always and altogether greater there, wherever that there may be, is an idea that has to be birthed out of a belief that man, in fact, does live by bread alone. It has to be. Everything is altogether worse over there because we don't need much here. Depends how you define our needs. My hope over these next few weeks is that we be challenged with three things. One, missions must begin at home. That it's not an either or thing, it's a both and thing. I say that much. Not either or, it's both and. We need to do missions here and we need to do missions there. We're all together committed to missions there. We're all together committed to missions here. But we don't just do church here and do missions there. It's all missions. And it has to begin here. We just came through the book of Acts. Starts in Jerusalem, goes to Judea, Samaria, and to the ends of the earth. It goes from Jerusalem, the epicenter of the religious world, to Rome, the epicenter of the world of the day, the cultural world, the world in power, so to speak. The church, here's the second thing that I want to challenge us with over the next several weeks. The church doesn't do missions. The church is the mission. I've stated that. And third, the needs here, although physically and contextually different, are as eternally desperate. As Jesus said, it is far harder for the rich to enter the kingdom of heaven. So we are desperate. We have people in our city living on bread alone, but spiritually just as desperate. When you come back over the next four Sundays, what you're going to see is glimpses, testimonies, video glimpses of what's taking place here, what our desires are for the North Shore. You're going to get an update on Reality Vancouver, a church that we planted several years ago. You're also going to hear about church planting across the country. For I know many of you, if not most of you, have very little idea about what's going on across the country. And so we want to fill you in on some things and try to be helpful to you. You're going to hear a lot of stories about that. In addition, launching later this week, probably Thursday or Friday, will be a website, sentandsending.com, where you can track what's going on, find more information out from it. Now, to put some of you at ease, because when you say campaign, you get the heebie-jeebies, right? Come on. It's true. Campaign, heebie-jeebies. Fundraising, heebie-jeebies. Right? I get it. We get heebie-jeebies. We're not going to spend the next 4 weeks, all Sunday, of them walking through this campaign. We're just going to set aside a couple of minutes in each gathering over the next 4 weeks. We'll have a campaign table, right? Just, it's a table. We're calling it the campaign table, where you can go find out more information about what's going on, those kinds of things. In fact, next Sunday, we are starting a new series on Habakkuk. So that's going to be fantastic. Our goal is for pregnant ladies, at least a couple of you, to name your child Habakkuk. We're just going to fire you up, boy or girl. It's going to be great. Because if it's a girl, you can shorten it to Habby, right? If it's a guy, I don't know. Cuck. It's not. Today, moving on. Today, really quickly, come with me. Come with me. Today. Whew, I want to answer the question. We're not going to upload the second gathering on the website. Today, I want to answer the question in this sort of transition Sunday, why church planting? Doing so by offering some contextual sort of background on why church planting. It's not entirely contextual. There are some biblical reasons. In fact, the first one that I'll give is a biblical reason. But there will be some contextual backing that I'll try to help us taste a little bit. And then we're going to go in Ephesians chapter 3, verses 8 to 10. And we're going to give you several other reasons why church planting coming out of that text. Okay, so that's what we're going to do. But before doing that, I want to take at least 2 or 3 minutes just giving you some details regarding the Westside North Shore campus very quickly, because I know that we get many people new to us, many people that are somewhat newer, and you haven't heard much about it. So let me take 1 or 2 minutes to do this. We are planting a campus. It's not a standalone church, but for all intents and purposes, it will look, smell, function, have a vibe of a standalone church. The only difference will be that it will serve and exist under the current leadership of Westside, meaning the Westside elders that exist now, the Westside staff, the Westside deacons, the Westside leadership teams, so on and so forth. They will provide oversight and leadership to both campuses. All right? So it will function like a standalone in terms of what people see when they walk through the door, but in terms of how it functions from a leadership standpoint, it will function under the current leadership of Westside. At the outset, however, James Bonney's role will change as he becomes the campus pastor of the new site. He'll be on the ground with his family there. Matt and Don Glezos with their family as well. My role, along with the Westside staff, will remain the same. I'll continue to be the lead pastor of Westside, the primary teaching pastor here. However, about once a month, I'll go over to the North Shore. I will speak there. James will, on occasion, be speaking here as well. Brett Landry will be going back and forth when necessary as a third teacher. In addition, the North Shore campus will teach the same series and the same text as we do here, but they will teach it a week behind. So if we're in week 3, for example, of a particular series, they'll be in week 2. But the North Shore campus community groups will follow the North Shore campus. So they won't follow the campus here. They'll follow the North Shore campus, meaning they'll be a week behind as well. The office on Broadway, if you've been there, current office that we have on Broadway will still serve as the office space for all Westside staff, North Shore or Vancouver. All other events, we get questions about this. What about this event? What about this class? What about this training? All of those kinds of things will be evaluated as we go, depending on need, right? Travel, interest, etc. In other words, some of the current stuff going on will continue to go on the way it goes on, and both campuses will be invited to it. However, Others may be exclusive to each campus, again, depending upon need, etc. All of this, what I've just said, will it be evaluated, changed, morphed, be recalibrated over time? I would think so. I would be surprised if it didn't. And some of it may get recalibrated and morph into something different very quickly. Lastly, we've been very purposeful in this initial stage to calling only those that are now living on the North Shore or are planning to move to the North Shore campus to be a part of the launch of this North Shore campus. However, we do anticipate and we're entirely comfortable with people coming from different parts of the city to gather there on Sunday. We would expect it. We would anticipate it. We're comfortable with it. As we say here often, we don't care where you come from to gather here on a Sunday. We just ask that when you scatter to your community groups, you scatter to a community group that exists in your community. Because that's where you do life most of the time, right? You come here for an hour and a half of celebration, worship, training, service, all of that. Then you launch out and scatter. And most of our lives are spent where we live. So we ask that you go to a community group if it works in the neighborhood or community where you live. All right, so with that out of the way, why church planting? Here's the first reason. It's the model of the New Testament. We just came through a 5,900-week study on the book of Acts. And one of the things that we've seen in the book of Acts is that the gospel establishment, right, in cities in which Paul, others, his cronies, his crew would go into, was through by the planting of churches. Paul was many things, but key among them was his role as an apostolic, meaning that he wouldn't stay for long. He would go in, start something, and move somewhere else, but he was an apostolic church planter. He would go in, he'd preach the gospel, people would come to Jesus, he would disciple them. From that group being discipled, he'd raise up leaders. From those leaders, he'd raise up elders. From those elders, he would establish a church, and he'd leave them be. Every once in a while, he and his cronies would go back, he'd strengthen them, speak into their lives, help them out, share some things, but then he would move on from there. It's the New Testament model. But I do know the pushback. That was then, Norman. That was then. All right. Nobody calls me Norman except my mom. Norman, that was then, this is now. Right? We have more than enough churches today. My response, quite simply, is we need more. If your perception is that the current health of the church in North America is good, then I am sorry to share with you that it's not. Across North America, churches have been leaking hundreds of people every week. Studies show that 80, by the way, of the churches that exist today in North America, and all these stats, by the way, that I'm going to give you, I'm not making them up and pulling them out of air. I can back them up, but I'm not going to footnote them this morning. But if you do have some desire to know where I'm getting this, I'd be happy to send that to you if you email the office. But studies show that 80 to 85% of churches that now exist in North America are on the downside of their life cycle. Meaning that 80 to 85% of all churches in North America have showed negative growth for at least 2 to 3 years. Some of them many years longer than that. Between the years 1980 and 2000, and I know that's going back 12 years, some of you haven't been born, right, past the year 2000, but between 1980 and 2000, 50,000 new churches were planted in North America. That's fabulous. I mean, that's a huge amount. 50,000 new churches planted in North America, that's good news. However, during that same period of time, an average of 3,500 to 4,000 churches shut down each year. Meaning if you do the math, that would mean that the net effect during that period of time was 20 to 30,000 less churches. Now, some would argue, that's not bad. Some churches need to shut down. You do hear that a lot, too. They need to shut down. If a church loses its way, right? Even Jesus said in his letters to the seven churches, specifically the church at Ephesus in Revelation 2, 1 to 7. In Revelation 2, 1 to 7, says, you guys have lost your first love, and if you don't figure out, repent, return to that which you had from the beginning, I'm pulling this bad boy out. This lampstand is going to get removed. So some churches, if they lose their way, lose their first love, they will be removed and removed by the will of Jesus. So we see that. And so I don't disagree necessarily with that idea. However, during that same period of time, when the churches that I'm giving during that period of time dropped or were removed or closed, church attendance also dropped by 9% as well. In other words, when churches closed down, it wasn't that a bunch of people then went to another church. They just stopped attending. To put it a different way, I agree. Some churches do need to shut down. What I'm arguing is the need for more gospel-centered, missionally-minded churches to replace them. You can't just have negative growth. You just can't. Some quick numbers about North America. The number of unchurched has almost doubled since 1991. North America stands as the largest mission field in the Western Hemisphere. In fact, in the U.S. itself is the fifth largest mission field on earth. In 1900, there are 28 churches for every 10,000 people. In today, there are 11 churches for every 10,000 people. So it's the model, right? Model that we've seen. We need more. Here's the third reason. More churches for more people is a more effective strategy for reaching the city. Big churches are vital. Big churches offer resources and abilities, and they just can do some things that smaller churches can't do. But that being said, generally speaking, more and smaller neighborhood churches are more effective in reaching a city. There's a book that came out. Some of you have, I'm sure, read it. Malcolm Gladwell's book, The Tipping Point, how little things can make a big difference. He defines a tipping point in his book, the point at which a series of small, ineffective changes acquires enough pressure or importance to cause a larger, more significant one. Pastor, author, theologian, missiologist Tim Keller writes that a citywide gospel tipping point is reached when the number of Christians in a city becomes large enough that Christian influence on civic and social life of the city and culture is recognizable and acknowledged. In certain cities, some groups, Christian or otherwise, have a palpable effect on the way that life is lived when their numbers reach 5 to 15% and they're very involved in civic and social life. Meaning they don't just navel gaze, right? Hang out with other people that navel gaze, right? Hang out with one another, do potlucks, listen to Avalon. I'm talking about people that are involved in social and civic life. They live in the city. They love the city. They affect the city. That type of thing. 5 to 15% can change the culture of a particular city. Studies, for example, show that if 10% of inmates become Christians, it changes the corporate culture of a prison, interestingly enough. Studies also show that neighborhoods stay largely the same if less than 5% of the population compose its makeup. A citywide gospel tipping point occurs, Keller argues, when the number of Christians and churches doubles every 7 to 10 years. I gave you some statistical backing for the plight of North America and what's going on in the church in North America. In Vancouver, those numbers are only magnified. Outside of Quebec City and Montreal, Vancouver is the most spiritually desperate city in North America. On an average Sunday, and studies are hard to come by and people disagree over them, but I think this is a fair number based on what we've seen. About 2 to 3% of the population of Vancouverites attend an evangelical Christian church on a Sunday. And when I talk about Vancouver, I'm talking about the city of Vancouver, the 600,000 or so people that make up the city of Vancouver. Now, I know the pushback, again, at this point. I see a lot of church buildings around. Would it be better to simply get those churches that exist in those buildings or other churches that don't exist in buildings but they're on a negative decline? Wouldn't it be better to get them turned around? Well, it would be. In fact, I think both things need to happen. I think churches need to be turned around. We need to be praying about that. We need to encourage that. And new churches need to be planted. However, numbers also show that it is far easier to plant a new church than to turn around a dying one. Tom Rainer, he wrote a book called Breakout Churches. And in it, what they do in his ministry, they surveyed 50,000 churches around North America. And they found in these 50,000 churches, and the grouping was brought together, these are churches that qualify that over their history, perhaps a history that they're in right now, that they were at that point in time or had been at a certain point in time in a period of decline. negative growth, people not coming to Jesus, no baptisms or very few, those types of things. Of the 50,000 churches surveyed, how many with their current leadership were able to reverse fortune, so to speak, change the tide, so to speak, go from decline to increase? Of the 50,000 under the current leadership, 13 were able to do so. In other words, just from a number standpoint, it's almost impossible. Under current leadership. Now, there are some churches that turn the tide, and how they turn the tide is they remove the lead guy, certainly. Move the lead guy, get rid of the elders, get rid of, you know, the leadership, change the mission statement, all of those kind of things, to which I would argue that's kind of like a church plant. When you remove the leadership, bring in new leadership. When you change the mission, that's like a church plant. So it's not surprising that those churches are more successful in being turned around. So these 13 out of the 50,000 were under current leadership. By the way, this shouldn't surprise us that churches have a tough time turning around when they're dying, because it's not easy for you or I to turn around, let alone a church. Studies show that 9 in 10 people who are told by doctors change or die cannot. In other words, the doctor says, stop smoking, lose weight, stop drinking, or you're going to die. You won't survive. 9 out of 10 die rather than change. So you put a bunch of people together, smokers, drinkers, overweight people in a church. You know what I'm saying? It's tough, man. Here's a fifth reason to plant a church. Very encouraging, aren't I? Well, here's a fifth reason. New churches, and some people get fired up when I say this, so I'll back it up. Don't throw anything at me. New churches are far more effective than established ones. Now, I know when you say that, people get really fired up. And I'm including Westside as an established church. We're no longer a new church. We're an established church. So I'm putting us in this group. But studies, again, show, and there are exceptions. There are some established churches that are doing fantabulous work. I get that. I believe that. There are great churches in the city. There are great churches on the North Shore. There's great churches across the country. I believe that with all of my heart. But studies can't be ignored that show that churches under 3 years of age win an average of 10 people to Jesus for every 100 members. Churches in years 3 to 15 win an average of 5 people for every 100 members. And all churches in this study, 15 plus, win an average of 3 people a year for every 100 members. Why? Because the greatest danger to a church and its mission is comfort, indifference, and apathy. All things easy to fall into in churches that have existed even only for a few years. New churches, to survive and establish themselves, necessitate that all people serve, give, invite, pray, share, and so on. I say to our leadership all the time, we can make no decisions here in this ministry out of fear. Any decision that we make out of fear is not faith-based, because the opposite of faith is fear. And so we as leaders can do nothing out of fear. Fear that causes us not to go, fear that causes us to go. We can do no fear-based decision-making. I say that all the time. They get sick of me saying it. So we can't be fearful. But just as important is that we can make no decisions birthed out of a people group's apathy and indifference. So a lot of people, they share their opinion, but it's birthed out of apathy and indifference. That's why I love Westside. You're not an apathetic group. You're not indifferent. Across the board. I mean, it's unbelievable. Paul writes in the book of Philippians, he just wants to boast about the Philippian church. I boast about Westside all the time. I love this ministry. I love you. I love what you do. I mean, we change here fast, right? 2 gatherings. Why don't we start a third tomorrow, right? Why don't we just change campuses? Why don't we do that? Let's hire 3 people this week. Fantastic. All right, we do. What's it? Plant a church. Great. Let's do it. All right, what are we going to do in the afternoon? Right? We do that a lot. And then we just fire off an email. Right? We fire off an email and go, well, we can't do it. I know you can't do it. I know you. You're a clown. You're a bozo. You certainly can't do it, Funk. I know. But the Westside body is money. It's money. And we love that you don't have apathy and indifference. As you turn to Ephesians 3, if you're not turned there already, let me quote from missiologist Leanne Aronofsky. I hope I have her last name right. She writes, without the sending aspect of God's character, he remains aloof and distant. Without the sent one, Jesus Christ, Christology becomes merely anthropocentric, meaning humans are at the center. Most significant, anthropocentric. And without the outward orientation of missions, the church becomes ingrown, complacent, and ethnocentric, meaning that our culture is superior. She then finishes this particular statement by writing, the history of the expanding church is the history of missions. In other words, the church doesn't do missions. The church is the mission. Which takes us to Ephesians 3, 8 to 10. I've given you five reasons thus far. Let me spend what time I have remaining by giving you five more that come out of these three verses. All right, let me read them. Ephesians 3, 8 to 10. To me, Paul the Apostle is writing this. Where is he writing this? He's in Rome, just like we looked at last week. He's in prison. He's writing this. To me, though I am very least of all the saints, this grace was given. To preach to the Gentiles the unsearchable riches of Christ and to bring to light for everyone what is the plan of the mystery hidden for ages in God who created all things. We'll unpack that verse because there's a lot in there. But what you do need to get out of verse 9 is there's been a mystery that's been in the works hidden and now it's revealed. All right, just keep that in mind. We'll come back to that. So that through the church, the manifold wisdom, multi-sided, right? It's like a beautiful diamond, has many sides, manifold, multi-sided wisdom of God, might now be made known to the rulers and authorities in the heavenly places. I said, I've got five more reasons why we should plant, be about proclamation ministry. If the best way achieving it, if there's a need, is through the planting of churches, what is another reason coming out of this? Well, the sixth reason, first out of this text, is we get to. But not just we get to, but in spite of who we are, we get to. It's been graced to us. In spite of Paul's unworthiness, and he says, I am the very least of all the saints, I get to proclaim Jesus. Literally, what he says there, in spite of being less of the least, I get to tell others about the grace of Jesus. In other words, Westside, to put it this way, the grace package that we receive from God through Jesus includes proclamation. We receive grace, but the grace extends in that we're allowed to participate in the proclamation of the gospel, allowed to participate in the expansion of God's kingdom. And as I'm arguing, and I will argue further as we get further into this text, through the church. Now, I know when I say it's the grace of God that you and I get to proclaim, some of us go, I don't like proclaiming. I get scared proclaiming. I'm fearful of proclaiming. I don't proclaim. I get that too. I understand that. I do. I understand that. I think there's a couple of reasons for that. Some are we just need to be praying more for boldness. I mean, for you who are nervous, scared, fearful to be a proclaimer, meaning just you and a buddy talking, when I talk about proclamation, that's most often how our proclamation takes place. Just need to be praying for boldness. I mean, that's our study of the book of Acts. That the Holy Spirit would just the Spirit, all right, the Spirit filling, leading to boldness and sharing. So we need to be praying more. Some of us, however, need to get to the point where we do think that the grace of Jesus is immeasurable. You know what I mean? That his riches far outweigh the riches of anything that we would receive here. See, some of us don't share Jesus because we don't really think that he's immeasurably great. So I think there's a convincing that needs to take place. I think there's that aspect. Then I think we need to be praying more. We do need to get trained more. And we do need support. We do need help. We need all of that. But what I want us to see is that proclamation is part of that grace package. Why, by the way, did Paul consider himself the very least of the saints? Well, I think the answer to that question is found in 1 Corinthians 15:9, and you can read that on the screen, where he writes, I am the least of the apostles. unworthy to be called an apostle. Why? Because I persecuted the church of God. I think that's why he calls himself in 1 Timothy chapter 1, the chief among sinners, because he killed Christians. But what's important for us to see here as well is that it didn't cause him to wallow in self-pity. Paul didn't have a self-esteem problem. That wasn't his issue. Meaning that if we're to come and go, Paul, you know what? Your issue is you have a self-esteem issue. It's not his issue. He didn't cause him to wallow in self-pity, nor did it exclude him from God's reach. See, some of us have taken ourselves out of the game. You know, we're not this participant. Not me, man. My past. But this didn't handcuff Paul, nor did it keep him from God's reach, God's grace extended to him. This is, by the way, a great picture of the gospel. This is who I was then. This is what God did for me now through Jesus. And this is how it expresses itself now. This is Paul's testimony. Jesus is the message. We are the messengers. Jesus is the story. I'm the storyteller. What keeps us from proclamation is confusing the two. Paul's past didn't hinder his present or his future. But he did have a keen sense of God's gracious act of allowance. I think there's a great balance in there. I could talk more about that. I don't have the time. Here, let me give you a seventh reason why church planting, the second coming out of these three verses. And this is in verse 9, and I think this is so tasty, and I hope I do a good job explaining this. But the seventh reason is, if God has created all things, then we have to believe that he can redeem all things too. Like, take a look at verse 9. Put your heads, eyes in verse 9. It says, to bring to light for everyone what is the plan of the mystery hidden for ages in God who created all things. And you're like, Paul, why are you throwing that in there? Why are you throwing in the fact that God created all things? Well, I think the reason why Paul is doing this in the context of the larger book of Ephesians is, and I said it in my point, is that if it's true, if this is true, that God is indeed the creator of all things, then wouldn't it make sense, doesn't it make sense, that God would be able to move and work and save everything he created? All things created. What we discover in verse 9, when put in context with the rest of Ephesians, is that God's creation did not, nor does it today, in any way fight against his plan of redemption and reconciliation, but instead it helps it along to its accomplishment. Just go back. Let me show you one verse, and I wish I could show you more, but look at verse 11. Verse 11 of chapter 1, Paul writes there, in him, okay, this is God through Christ. In him, we have obtained an inheritance, having been predestined. I know people get really freaked out about the word predestined, the word election. I like what Greg Laurie says. I believe in election, but I always pray that God would go ahead and elect some more. Okay, so just take that, use that as your verse of prayer as well. Having predestined according to the purpose of him. Plan, purpose, will of him who works all things according to the counsel of his will. Let me see if I don't want to lose anybody. This is what Paul is saying. God's created all things. From the beginning of time, this mystery that is now being revealed to us, those that have resisted him haven't messed up the plan and mystery of his desire, plan, and purpose. They haven't got in the way of it. Instead, they are being used to bring it to its fulfillment. That's why Paul says in verse 9, God's created all things. He's in charge. He's the creator of everyone. And now he's revealing his plan and purpose through Jesus, and he's going to bring everything together according to his plan and purpose and will. And those that he elected, predestined since the beginning of time, going to come to Jesus. Nothing's going to thwart that. Nothing's going to get in the way of that. So when we look to our world, just using it in the context of what we're doing on the North Shore. And I know this is obvious, but I'm going to say it anyway. Just because many people in this city don't believe they have a creator doesn't mean that people in this city don't have a creator. See, here's what I have to believe about the North Shore. God has some children over there. And they just don't know it yet. And I think that we can be the ones who have the privilege of letting some of them know. Here's an eighth reason. For the church is the vehicle that God uses to make himself known. Take a look at verse 10. So if you're not convinced yet, look at verse 10. It says, through the church, the manifold wisdom of God might be now be made known to the rulers and authorities in heavenly places. Through the church. Now, I do know what people do in light of verses like this. We're all part of the church, Norman, right? We're all part of the church, right? Part of the church, part of the global church. I don't need to be a part of a local church. I couldn't disagree more with you. I agree that you're part of the global church. I couldn't agree more with you on that. You're not only part of the global church, you're part of the historical church, right? So I'll add one for you, right? You're part of that church too. So I agree with you. But you're also to be a part of a local community of faith. I'll get to the reason why a little bit later, but let me just say this. Most every letter that Paul writes in the New Testament is written and needs to be read in the context of a local body of Christ, a local community of faith. He writes things in there that are true for all churches locally established around the world. But they need to be read in the context of a local body of Christ. Whether that context is a group of 100, five in a living room, or tens upon thousands in a big metropolis somewhere. But they need to be read in context of that. This letter in the book, or this letter to the Ephesians, is written to the church at Ephesus. When they read it in the context of, here's Paul's instruction to us. Now, does what Paul writes to the church at Ephesus apply to us? Certainly it does. But it needs to be read in that context. A couple things to hit in this, that it is through the church that God makes himself known. The first thing to note, it is through the church and not by the church. It's through the church, not by the church. God is the worker, in other words. The church is the conduit. See, with all due deference to those who will state at times, the church is the hope of the world, I disagree. The church is not the hope of the world. Jesus is the hope of the world. The church is the mouthpiece. It's a vehicle of that hope. But that being said, it is through the church. It's through the church that God makes his manifold wisdom known. And this is a wonder when you think about it. I want us to taste this because God in his sovereign grace has chosen to use me and you. And note, just look at the progression in verses 8, 9, and 10. Note the progression of who the message of God's hope through Jesus goes to. In verse 8, it begins with the Gentiles, right? He says, I preach to the Gentiles. In verse 9, it goes to everyone. I'm going to bring to light to everyone. But then look, in verse 10, it's to the rulers and authorities in heavenly places. I mean, note what Paul is saying in verse 10. To put it in layman's terms, God lets the heavenlies in on things by what he does in and through the church. Like, think about that. I mean, if 1 Peter 1, 10 to 12 tells us that God reveals things in and through the church that angels long to see. It's amazing. God uses the church. Us. And what is he revealing? Well, he's revealing that everyone can be brought together. Jew, Gentile, slave, free, women, men, rich, poor, black, white, all can be brought together in one body because of the work of Jesus, because of the common ground of Jesus. And Paul, again, serving as that example that nothing gets in the way of the arm and the reach and the grace of Jesus, not even if in your past you murdered Christians. That his grace can even extend to that, and not only just extend to a point of forgiveness, extend to a point where you get to participate. It's unbelievable. I mean, we should just stop, drop, right? I mean, it's unbelievable. Angels, wonder what God is going to do with them. That's crazy. Oh man, I got to close. I'm not ready to. Real quick. I need to wrap up real quick. Ninth reason to plant churches: the cosmic forces can do nothing to stop the church. Why do I make that point? Well, I have to think that the heavenly rulers spoken of here include those who are enemies of Jesus. In response to God's work through Jesus, what's the best that they can do? In response to the work of Jesus, what he accomplished, what's the best they can do? They can put up gates in the hope to keep what is theirs now. That's the best they can do. That's why Jesus said, when he was raising the leadership of Peter for the early church, states to Peter, "I will build my church. I will. And the gates of hell shall not prevail against it." You know what gates are? You've heard this before. It's not my idea. I don't know who originated it, but I'm going to borrow it. Gates are defensive, right? You don't ever get scared of gates. Whoa, there's a gate, right? Gates are just defensive. Gates are trying to keep stuff they got in there. Don't come in here, right? Gates are defensive. Jesus says, "No, I'm going to build my church, and those gates, if I've got people there, I'm going to get them. Not going to prevail." Right? That's what gates do. Gates are made to be climbed over, broken down. You know what I mean? I remember driving down, my wife reminded me of this, between the first and the second gathering, driving down to Pebble Beach. And Pebble Beach, everybody talks about Pebble Beach Golf Course, but there's a really nice golf course on 17-mile drive on the Carmel Peninsula called Cypress Point. It's exclusive, very exclusive, extremely exclusive. I wanted in. I drove up, and it's got a little sign, like this big, like, you know, cool member, like big people that have big signs are not really cool. The little ones, you're like, that's exclusive. So you drive, just says Cypress, and there's a gate there. Ticked me off. I wanted in. I wanted what was on the other side. That's what Jesus is saying. That gate, not going to prevail against me. I'm going to build my church, and those who are his now, I'm taken. Because I got a plan and a purpose that I'm bringing to fulfillment. I've got those that I've chosen since the beginning of time. I want them. And I'm going to get them. I'm going to build it. Before I get to my last point, sorry for shouting. I'm not angry. Fired up. Not angry. I got a big thing of chili waiting for me at home. I haven't eaten much in the last 12 weeks, and I'm going to eat a lot. Yes, I am. It's going to be great. I need to close. Before I get to my last point, one last clarifier of what Paul means when he says, writes, by the church. This isn't talking primarily about the actions or the programs of the church. This is simply by the existence of a church that's in unity. This isn't like through the church, come up with this program, come up with this. This is a body of people coming together under the unity of the gospel and the world going, wow. Wow. That's why Jesus says in John 13:35, by this, all people will know that you are my disciples if you have love for one another. And that's why if you think that you can go about living for Jesus by yourself and you don't need the body, you're like a toe saying, I don't have any need for a foot. And you can't say that. Because Jesus works through the body. He works through the body. That's how he makes himself known, through the unity of the body, forbearance with one another because of the gospel. Lastly, why do we need to plant churches? Because now is the time. Now is the time. Take a look at verse 10. Paul writes, it's through the church the manifold wisdom of God might now be made known to the rulers and authorities in heavenly places. Now is the time. Westside, I understand the need for prudence and leadership. I get wisdom. I get the wisdom that comes in the weight. I think there's wisdom that does come in the weight. But I also understand that what some call prudence can be a mask for indifference and fear. Jesus' words uttered 2,000 years ago still apply today. Do not say, there are yet 4 months, then comes the harvest. Look, I tell you, lift up your eyes. And see that the fields are white for the harvest. Westside, now is the time. What are we waiting for? Now is the time. The only issue is that the harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Therefore, we need to be praying earnestly to the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers into his harvest. So would you rise with me as we go into a time of response?